Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to Coast, This Week in America. Sherwood by Betty Hurst is three stories in one. A coming-of-age novel, a psychological study of selfless search for love and meaning, and an inquiry into the nature of truth and beauty. Colleen, Pete, Brett, Laura, Will, and a dark outsider known only as the Handyman form a cast of characters whose decisions and actions take place in the era of the TB Sanitarium in post-World War II America, but they are as timeless as philosophy, religion, and man's quest for meaning. Betty earned a BA in philosophy from Penn State and a teaching certificate in French and Spanish from Towson State University. Her husband is a physicist, and her daughter has had a successful career in television journalism. Betty and her husband live in Maryland. U.S. Review of Books says Sherwood is a narrative crafted with grace and precision, a vivid story keenly observed, a heartbreaking and inspiring story that will have you gripped from beginning to end. And Betty Hurst, author of Sherwood, joins us on This Week in America. Hi, Betty. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This is such a remarkable job that you've done with this book on so many layers, and I'm really fascinated by the book and looking forward to having you on the program today. What inspired you to write the book?
I was at a church meeting where everyone was asked to introduce themselves. A woman older than me said, "My name is Helen, and I grew up on the porch of a TB sanitarium." I was riveted by her words because I knew they would make a great book. So after the meeting, I asked her if she would be interested in having me write a book about her experiences, and she immediately agreed.
It's amazing the influence she had on you and the book, and we'll talk about that as we go through the conversation today. The book is Sherwood. It's written by Betty Hurst, B-E-T-T-E-H-U-R-S-T, the book available wherever books are sold. On the back cover of your novel, you write that it is a coming-of-age story. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of the novel.
Just let me say to start off with that Helen wanted her name to be Colleen in my novel. Colleen is only 15 when she is diagnosed with TB and admitted to a TB sanitarium. It was a state sanitarium for patients who could not afford the cost of a private sanitarium. In my novel, I called it the Sherwood TB Sanitarium. At 15, Colleen is at a perfect age for a character in a coming-of-age novel. Colleen discovers that nearly all of Sherwood's patients are adults. The only patient who doesn't treat her like a child is a young man named Pete. Pete is 19, and he quickly recognizes that she is mature beyond her years. Their relationship begins with their mutual love of music and ends tragically with his death. They know each other for almost a year. His sudden death has a huge effect on Colleen. In the rest of the novel, she tries to make sense of his life and death through the lens of his philosophy.
Colleen is so well, as all the characters are, so well developed, and we really root for her, we understand her, we watch her come of age in this book, the historical fiction, the historical novel Sherwood by Betty Hurst. If you're Googling, Betty is B-E-T-T-E, Hurst, H-U-R-S-T. Our website, booksbybettyhurst.com. And if you go to our website, thisweekinamerica.us, you can link on directly to get information from Betty's website and order the book there as well. Sherwood is part love story, part racial drama. There are basically two themes in your book. One is the conflict between Pete and Brett to win Colleen's attention and love. Tell us a little bit about that. How did that story develop?
The rivalry between these two very different young men begins when Colleen and Pete are moved into the recovery building, which was located behind the main hospital. Colleen first meets Brett in the dining room, and she is quickly attracted to his good looks and charm. Meanwhile, Pete and Colleen begin meeting in a third-floor apartment in order to play a grand piano, which is strictly against the rules. Colleen finds Pete's intellect and tremendous piano talent almost overwhelming, yet they become fast friends. He only sees a lovely and very musical young woman whom he finds delightful. When a nurse reports their meetings, Dr. Kurtz orders them to stay away from the piano room permanently. Nevertheless, Pete continues to go there, sometimes with Colleen, and that is a bridge too far for Brett. By now, Brett cares very much about Colleen and warns her that their visits could kill her or Pete. He tells Pete the same thing, but Pete no longer trusts Brett because of their rivalry for Colleen, and he will not listen.
Interesting, as that story develops in Sherwood by our guest on the program, Betty Hurst, I mentioned a secondary theme in the book. Where did you get the idea to create the interracial love story as that secondary theme? And how does that conflict with Will and the handyman that I mentioned before, how did that arise?
I got the idea for the racial conflict from a photo of a black groundskeeper who brought Helen and her porchmate some kittens. I called the groundskeeper Will, and Will provided a natural scapegoat for the handyman's racism. Will was well-educated in Haiti and has natural dignity and friendliness. The handyman is a womanizer and a thief. He resents it when Will receives praise for the foot warmers he makes for the women. The handyman also knows that Colleen saw him steal her book. Soon the handyman begins to act out his racial jealousy, and he publicly accuses Will of lusting after Colleen and her porch mates, even though Nurse Marta always invites Will to come in with the kittens. The handyman begins to watch in the shadows on evenings when Will visits with Laura through the screens. It finally dawns on the handyman that Laura and Will have fallen in love. One night when the handyman overhears Sherwood's photographer offer Will an evening job at his house down on the main highway, the handyman follows Will down Sherwood's secluded driveway and tries to kill him with a rock. The handyman also slashes Will's hand with a knife in a rooftop stairwell when Will asks him to return Colleen's book. However, none of the handyman's violent acts succeed in frightening Will away until the handyman turns his attention to Laura's favorite kitten. Knowing that the handyman can pick the time and place of his attacks, and fearing worse danger for Laura, Will decides to leave Sherwood and go to Chicago.
This is all unfolds in Betty's book. The book is a riveting historical novel. It's called Sherwood. You'll find the book available wherever books are sold, published by Gotham Books. Their website, GothamBooksInc.com. Betty's website, BooksByBettyHurst.com. Links for all on our website, ThisWeekInAmerica.us. As Betty's telling the story, it comes to life. I can see the story unfolding, and it's just like that in the book. You feel like you're there. You do not want to put the book down, and you want to go on to the next chapter. Even though it's maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, you want to find out what happens with all of these characters. It's a riveting book. The book is called Sherwood. The two stories reach a climax at the Halloween party. Now, I don't want you to give away too much here, but this really is a climactic turning point in the story. Tell us what you can about the Halloween party and the impact that has on everybody's lives.
Well, for one thing, this is when Pete dies. I won't tell you why or how, but it is a beautiful and very pure moment, and heartbreaking as well. On the night of Sherwood's Halloween party, Pete is confined to bed with a fever. Colleen comes to see him and promises to bring him some cookies after the party. It was to have been their first date, and Pete had planned to be a vampire. On the day before the party, on the way to dinner, Pete pretends to bite Colleen's neck, but instead, she feels a kiss. He holds her, and for the first time, she sees fear in his eyes, and this shocks her. He puts on a brave face, but not before telling her, "Don't ever forget me." Meanwhile, Pete's rival, Brett, has planned a way to steal a kiss from Colleen during the last skit of the Halloween party. It brings down the house when he succeeds. At that point, utter pandemonium begins. Pete had once mentioned to Colleen that Halloween is a night for Freud's death instinct, a night for scaring ourselves and releasing our inner wolf. Colleen thinks of this when she sees the handyman's face pressed against the dining room window. He sees Dr. Smith and draws back, but he shakes his fist at Colleen. It's clear he's bent on evil. As Pete is dying, the handyman exacts his revenge in a deplorable act that endangers everyone in the hospital. By the time the police arrive, the handyman has disappeared into the night. When Colleen discovers that Pete has died, she feels more alone than she has ever felt in her life. The next morning, Will accepts a ride to Chicago with Colleen's brother and parents in order to escape from the handyman.
Boy, there is so much there, and you will enjoy the story as it unfolds in Betty's book, Sherwood, book available wherever books are sold. Now, after Pete's death, a brand new wing opens at the hospital. In what way is this sort of a new phase for the story?
This begins the long denouement in which Colleen comes of age without Pete. After Pete's death, Colleen and her friends are glum. He was the center of their unique fellowship, and nothing can bring him back. No one wants to talk about his death. Then Colleen and Brett are moved to the new wing. The atmosphere is not as cozy and personal as it had been in the recovery building. A new nurse has replaced the kindly Miss Marta. However, the new wing is sparkling clean and equipped with the latest equipment. Outdoor porches are no longer deemed necessary, and the medical staff is hoping streptomycin will bring a long-sought cure for TB. Until then, compression therapy continues in the new wing. Brett can no longer get away with his pranks under the regime of a humorless head nurse. Still, he and Colleen keep up their courage and eat together, while Brett wages a war against a prim critic named Angela. But one by one, the band of friends dwindles. After Will leaves Sherwood, Laura leaves to go find him in Chicago. Then Abby, who is Colleen's closest friend, is discharged. This leaves Brett and Colleen. When Brett is discharged, Colleen experiences true despair. Her lonely nights are filled with the thought that her lung still has an olive-sized cavity in it. Her lung is still too elastic for the therapy to work. All of Pete's beautiful words about hope ring hollow now, and Colleen fears she will never get to go home. Her high school classmates send her their yearbook with a full-page photo in her honor, but the truth is that they will be graduating in June and moving on while she is still at Sherwood and three grades behind.
Wait, we are really pulling for Colleen. So how does Colleen find, how does she get discharged? Up to this point, we're wondering what's going to happen. We really are attached to Colleen. When does she get discharged? How does she get discharged?
She gets a bad cold when they allow her to go home for a week at Christmas. When she returns to Sherwood, her cold worsens, and eventually Colleen develops fluid around her lungs. The fluid finally squeezes the cavity shut. 2 months later, on her 18th birthday, Colleen is discharged from Sherwood on a beautiful day in May.
So she does get discharged. She gets to go home. How does her life, how has it changed during those 3 years that she's been gone? It's been 3 years since she, almost 3 years since she left for the sanitarium. How has life changed for her? What's her life like when she gets back home?
This new chapter in Colleen's life begins with a long interior monologue about time and change. This is railroad and coal country, and the book has a whole different feeling than Louisville and Sherwood. The only thing that hasn't changed is the endless flow of the Green River out of the coal-bearing mountains. Colleen's formal schooling will begin only after she returns to Sherwood for one final treatment. To her surprise, Brett is at Sherwood for a checkup. His life is hard because he must care for his ailing father, and he drives a cab at night, but he promises to take her to the Kentucky Derby when they recover. The doctors crush Colleen's phrenic nerve to force her diaphragm higher for one last round of slow healing of the cavity. After 6 months, she returns to Sherwood for a checkup. She overhears Dr. Smith tell his assistant that lung will never reinflate. She keeps this to herself, not wanting to worry her parents. Her only close friend is the boy next door, who, like Pete, is intensely musical. The final two chapters are quite lyrical. Colleen's life is not dramatic, but through her thoughts and compositions, Colleen is revealed to be a young woman with a deep and reflective kind of intelligence well beyond a typical adolescence. Her years at Sherwood have taken her on a complete detour around her teenage years, to which she can never return.
The book is Sherwood, the author, Betty Hurst, BETTEHURST. If you're Googling, is the author and our guest. Her website is booksbybettyhurst.com. Book, of course, available at Amazon. The publisher is GothamBooksInc.com, and all of this on our website. Let's talk about Colleen. How have things changed, and how was she able to change when she goes home? A small town, few opportunities. You read a minimum high school schedule, no practical courses. Not even a typing course was offered for her. How was she able to go back and thrive like she would like to?
Well, change comes abruptly when Colleen graduates at the age of 20, but only after the boy next door is drafted into the Korean War and Colleen's life is thrown into confusion and loss again.
I guess the big question, and again, without giving too much away, does she really find happiness after all the setbacks that were there for she's experienced throughout the book? Is she able to find happiness?
Yes. She answers a help wanted ad and accepts a job as a child care helper to a man named Richard. Richard lives out in the country with his autistic son and is busy selling his mother's house and settling her estate. Colleen watches the little boy whenever Richard is too busy to do so. By summer's end, Richard and Colleen have fallen in love. They move to Baltimore, where he plays French horn in the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. After they marry, they move into his small townhouse with a little garden in the back for his son to play in. Colleen continues to try to find a way to help Richard's son, David. The book's final chapter closes as Colleen and David attend a performance of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. She knows that the boy will face discrimination and difficulty during his life, but Colleen has borne the stigma of TB and knows how to deal with prejudice. The first movement's short motif reverberates through the concert hall like a musical victory over despair. But Colleen is forced to leave when David becomes restless. He does, however, recognize Richard's horn and echoes, "A," when he hears the orchestra tune up. These are some of the small signs of his innate musicality, which Colleen hopes to nurture. David also has perfect pitch. And so she is not afraid of the future. She has learned what it is to leave the real world and enter a world apart. She thought she had lost paradise when Pete died, but she has regained it in Richard. Now, in an ironic twist of fate, David's treatment will try to pull him from his autistic world into the real world. This will be a daunting task because his autism is severe. There will be no guarantees, but Colleen finds hope as a bird fills her garden with music and David listens.
Remarkable story told by Betty Hurst, our guest on the program, in her book, Sherwood. What did you learn from writing Sherwood? What impact did that have on you, the author?
I think I learned that there are always more questions than there are answers. Sherwood is filled with thoughts and conversations of all of the eight main characters. I think the reader will find much to ponder in them. TB is still present in many parts of the world today, so Sherwood is a cautionary tale and a warning that we must guard against antibiotic resistance to TB, lest we return to the days of Sherwood. There is also the mystery of Pete. He believed in a God to be found in music, a God that is an intimation of the beauty in us, if only we will listen, a God that is like, as Albert Schweitzer once wrote, a pure and distant melody coming to us across the noise and busyness of the world. A God that guides us with beauty as well as truth. Brett believed Pete recklessly endangered his own life for an illusion and false God. The others also had their opinions of Pete. As for me, I think it is possible that Pete was a realist who knew that time is almost always too short to find out what is ultimately beautiful and true while living in the carnival noise of the world. I also found myself constantly asking the question, who of all these characters would I have been? And I think the reader will as well.
Well, I'm glad I'm not alone, because as you're reading, you associate with all of these characters, but certainly some in particular. And it's a cast of eight main characters. As Betty talked about, the book is Sherwood. A few minutes left in the conversation. Let's talk about the challenges of writing a book like Sherwood with the number of characters. And you do such a remarkable job of giving us detail in all the characters. We feel like we know each of them individually. How difficult, how challenging was that for you to create these characters, to flesh them out as you have, and have the interaction between all of them? How challenging was that with all these characters, all these moving parts, and you pulled together so well?
Well, thank you. I identified with each one. I know Charles Dickens used to put himself in each part and act them out. You know, and he had thousands of characters in front of the mirror. I didn't act them out in front of the mirror, but I just got immersed in it. And also, my friend Helen, who really was responsible for giving me all the background of this story. I made up the plot, but she gave me pictures of some of her friends, which appear in the book, and I used all of them, and I would just look at those people. Pete didn't exist, actually, but many of them did. Many of the main characters did. And I could just feel it. And they, you know, it was back in the 40s, so they looked, you know, more like people from the 40s. And I could feel it. And I just let it go. And she also was a pianist and a composer herself. And she wrote many, many piano pieces. And I took all the titles and I rearranged them in the order I thought would fit the story. And it just, instead of an outline, I just worked for that. So sometimes I would play the music, and I could actually feel Helen's trauma. Yes. And I think this probably affected her more than anything in her life ever did. Well, and then when she had an autistic grandson, and she married her second husband, who is actually in this book, and he did play French horn for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, he helped her out greatly, as well as her own son, who was the actual father to the autistic son. And Helen went around all over our county and in the church itself, and she had a video of her grandson emerging from autism and the struggle that it was. A darling little boy about 4 years old. So that also inspired me, because I saw the actual son, and I visited her and saw him, and by the time I saw him, he might have been 6 or 7, and he had learned to read a bit, and I watched him stim from a video, meaning repeat a part over and over, and I saw how focused they can be, but also, I don't know, it traumatized me to see how much they struggle to catch on to what's really going on. Yes. And if something really catches their attention, they'll just look at it and look at it until they are satisfied.
You bring that up. Yeah, finish that thought. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, and then the conflict between Pete and Brett. Brett was actually named Bert, so I rearranged it to Brett. Pete actually was a young man that Colleen did not know, Helen did not know, and she was going to go into the treatment room where they would compress the lungs, and she was waiting outside, and she heard this Pete, cry out. And then Dr. Turner is the real name of the director of Sherwood. He was holding Pete's hand because suddenly Pete hemorrhaged and he was dying. He was all upset. And Dr. Smith, that's his name in the story, said, "It's all right, Pete." So when I have Pete die, I develop Pete completely from my imagination. And then he's... At the end, when he's alone with the piano trying to be heard down through the din of the Halloween party, and he's hemorrhaging, then the doctor comes upstairs and says, "It's all right, Pete," and he dies. But you know, the whole Halloween party is probably a 10-page tableau. It goes, you go back and forth between Pete upstairs in the forbidden room, and then Brett and everybody downstairs and all the things that go on, and then the handyman outside at the window. So it's sort of a great big composite and a long, long, long scene. It's the best scene in the book as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it is. It's got such a visual aspect to it.
And because it had action, I could write it. I wrote it all probably in an hour. It wrote itself, because the rest of the time I have people in bed and moving around a bit in ambulatory states, but it's much harder to write a book, and that's why there's so much static activity. So it became very important to develop the interrelationship between all those characters. And that was another driving factor. I just had to get into their minds, or I had no story.
Well, you've done a remarkable job.
I mean, there's a lot
job.
Of exciting things that happen, but it needed to have that backdrop of what they're going through.
You bring that out so well, and the stories are there, and it moves so well. You talk about the Halloween party that goes by so quickly, and it unfolds right before our very eyes, as it did for you, as it sounds like, as you were writing it. The book is so well done. The book is Sherwood by Betty Hurst. A remarkable job on this book. What are you working on now? You're a very gifted writer. Are you working on something else?
I have the idea for two more books. I don't know if I'll ever do them, but... I have written the first three chapters of one. It takes place in Vietnam. It involves a Native American. And then the last one, they all are going to investigate aspects of the arts. So that's going to be about the visual arts. And the last one's going to be about sculpture. And a little boy in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is going to visit with a man in a small cabin in the snowy winter. And through that relationship, the sculpture emerges, and you have to find out what the sculpture is going to be. So that's sort of, and so those are the three aspects of the arts I do: music, visual arts, and then the sculpture.
Well, looking forward to those as well, and I would love to have the opportunity when the books are finished to talk about those. It's been a pleasure, Betty, having you on the program today to talk about the book Sherwood. A really tremendous job you did in writing this book. It moves so well. You many layers to this. You'll love the characters. You will love the story. You go back in time and feel like you're during the 1940s as this was happening. Some pictures of the back of the book that will help set that time for you as you're reading the story. Congratulations on the success of Sherwood, and thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
It has been our pleasure. Betty Hurst, BetteHurst. Betty Hurst, the website is booksbybettyhurst.com. Our thanks to GothamBooksInc.com, the publisher, for arranging our conversation today. Book available, of course, at Amazon, wherever books are sold, and that direct link for Betty's website on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. You're listening to This Week in America, and we're back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.